We are continuing in this series called Rebranded as we're identifying the danger, possibly, at least the difficulty of simply calling ourselves Christians. While that word is found in the Bible, it is not clearly defined in the Bible. We said several weeks ago that a word that better characterizes what Christ is actually calling us to do is a word that Jesus used. That was the word disciple. I think last week we said that a Christian is often defined by the things that they believe. A disciple is defined by the things that they do. So as a disciple, that the thing that Christ calls us to do and to become has this activity to it. There is this activity level that rides underneath the surface that guides everything that we do. Last week we talked about the thing that Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 where he says, do not judge those outside of the faith, those outside of relationship with Christ. That's not your job to judge. He says, what business is it of mine if someone out there who has never committed their life to Christ doesn't live as Christ called them to live? Instead, he raises the level of accountability to those inside the faith. You and I who call ourselves Christians, who have signed on with God, that we would call ourselves disciples. He says, you are to hold one another to this high level of accountability. And the way that you love one another and treat one another determines how people on the outside see you. So if Paul says, don't judge those on the outside, and then Jesus also, this is out of John chapter 13, this is where we began this whole series, is Jesus says, the way that you love one another will tell people the kind of disciples that you are, the who you are following, who you are connected to in life. So he says, you need to love one another. That is the highest priority. That is the foundational piece of what it means to be a disciple. So if Paul says us, tells us not to judge, and Jesus says it is love that marks your life, what are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to live? What are the things that are supposed to mark our lives? All right, we're going to take that question. We're going to set it aside for a moment. Now, I won't leave it just sitting there. We will get to that. We will answer that question of what are we supposed to do? How is it that what are the characteristics of our life? Think instead for a moment about this. If you and I visited Rome today, if we went on a tour of the city and we saw maybe the prison that they think there's a prison that Paul the Apostle was in, and he was in chains, where he writes some of their letters to the early church. You can go and see that. You can certainly go and see some of the other amazing chapels and cathedrals that have been built. If you go to Rome and you take a tour of the city, you will see one thing that is very striking, and it is all over the city. They are crosses. They're on the tops of almost every building. They are on the gates going into different parts of the city. They are on doors and door frames. Crosses are everywhere in the city of Rome. Now, before we get ahead of ourselves and start thinking, well, the Pope lives there, don't you kind of have to have crosses like all over town? Remember back, I think we talked about this last week, that there was this massive period of persecution against Christians that lasted for about 300 years. It really got ramped up when Nero sees that his city is burning, and in the aftermath of the city burning, he needs someone to blame, and so he pins it to the Christians. That begins this long series of 300 or so years where there is just massive persecution against Christians. One of the things that happens while Nero is still in power is he creates this almost this place of sport. He calls it Nero's Circus. And one of the things that he does is he grounds up anybody who are enemies of the state, in particular Christians, because they were seen as enemies of the state. And so he would round up people, including Christians, and take them into the circus, and they would become sport for the head officials of the Roman Empire. And also, you could buy a ticket, and you could go and watch someone be completely demolished as a person, as a human being. Just have their limbs ripped apart and be treated as less than human. Now imagine, if you would, while all of this is going on, what if you had the opportunity in today, but to kind of go back in time and to speak to, maybe there's, imagine with me, if you will, a small family that are just outside of Rome, and they're hiding. And you had the chance to tell them, not in your lifetime and not really in your kids' lifetime, but in a relatively, over the course of all of history, relatively short period of time, eventually Christians will not be treated the way you are. In fact, it's not just going to be a cease and desist. It's not going to be, we're not going to pound you and punish you anymore. Rome is going to adopt Christ and Christianity as the official religion. You can imagine some of the pushback that would happen from those few families that are sitting there, fearing for their lives, thinking about, where do we got to go? How can we get away from this persecution? They probably would have said something like, all right, I have committed my life to Jesus, as my whole family has. And I believe in the teachings of Jesus, and I believe that Jesus is the way, and we need to have relationship with him, and all of those things. I have no trouble with any of that. But Rome, we're talking about Rome here. Rome is king. They have all the power. They have all the strength. They have all of the might. Why would they ever even let this happen? Right now, we are enemies of the state. Why would they change their mind? Why would they do that? Maybe you could talk about what happens over in about 336 AD, where Constantine adopts Christianity. Maybe you could tell them, look, it's not that far off. I know it's difficult now, but it's not that far away. I think it would be hard to accept that. I think that would be very difficult to think about the crosses that maybe their friends and family had been crucified on. And to say, look, all over the city of Rome, in the distant future, there will be crosses, and they won't be the kind of crosses that you're used to that represent death and destruction. There'll be beautiful crosses that commemorate the death and resurrection of one person, Jesus Christ, the one that you are following right now. I think that would have been very hard to hear, very hard to swallow. There's one big idea that I really want to land with us today, and that is that every single one of us, we show up in the lives of people in one form or another. We leave a legacy. We often talk about legacy as something that is good and it has meaning for your kids on down the road, that you leave a positive legacy. But the truth is, all of us leave a legacy. Sometimes our legacy is that of sorrow and sadness, of death. We all show up in lives of other people in one form or another. Sometimes we show up in very positive and helpful ways. And sometimes we show up in difficult and painful ways. And sometimes we show up in very nondescript, almost unimportant ways. That we do not leave an imprint on the lives of the people around us. As we think about all these things, go with me to Matthew chapter 5. This is the beginning of Jesus' ministry, and some significant things are about to drop for Jesus. If we understand the timeline of things and the context of history at that point, remember, Rome has not begun to outright persecute Christians yet, but they are taxing everyone in their wake, including the Christians. And the Christians are starting to feel some of the pressure, and they've been waiting for a Messiah that will liberate them, that will revolutionize the way in which they live and experience life. And so there's this guy, Jesus, and he is starting to gain some notoriety, starting to gain a little bit of fame, and people are starting to pay attention to him. And just think of yourself in that time frame. All right, hey, somebody comes knocking on your door and says, there's this guy, Jesus, and he is out on the mountain, and he is about to do some teaching. You need to come with me because I think he just might be the Messiah. Yeah, the Messiah, the one that we have been waiting for, the one that we've read about in all of the history books and all of the what we would consider the Old Testament. I think this guy might be the Messiah. And so on the hillside, there is this massive throng of people that are gathered. And this is the message that Jesus starts with. And if you've been around church for very long, you know this is the Beatitudes. He starts with some very simple, yet difficult to swallow things. He says, blessed are the poor, those that are in sorrow, those that are meek. Blessed are those that hunger and thirst. Blessed are the merciful, the peacemaker. Blessed are the persecuted. Now, again, imagine yourself. We know the end of the story. We know what Jesus is driving at. We know that he has a different kind of message, but put yourself in their shoes. You're sitting on the mountainside. You have Roman Empire just crushing you. They've taken your land. You have no standing with Rome whatsoever unless you pay your taxes, and even then, it's not much. And the whole rhetoric of the Messiah coming seems to be built around when the Messiah shows up, he is going to politically liberate us. He is going to change the political landscape. We're going to go back to a sovereign nation, and Rome can say goodbye. We're done with them. And this is what Jesus starts with. They were expecting something different. And he starts with this, blessed are the poor and the sorry and the meek and the humble, and blessed are you when people try to crush you. We were hoping for a political Messiah. We were hoping that this Jesus guy would be the one to change the political landscape. Aren't you glad we don't do that anymore with Jesus? I mean, that should be kind of funny because we kind of still do. We kind of still do expect Jesus to change the political landscape. They hear something very different from Jesus. They hear Jesus saying, blessed are the poor and the sorry, and if this becomes this, what kind of teaching? And probably before there could be much of an objection, Jesus continues to talk. Look at verse 13. He says, you are the salt of the earth. So he takes this abstract kind of head-scratching teaching of blessed are you when you're at the bottom of the barrel. And then he kind of sets that aside for a minute. He says, you are salt of the earth. Now, for us, salt is more of a flavor enhancer to stuff. For them, salt was a primary preservative, in particular for meat. So when you don't have refrigeration, when you don't have the ability to preserve something by keeping it cold, this is what they would do. Pack it in salt so the meat doesn't rot. And what he's saying to them, he's taking something that is a part of their daily lives. Either you were harvesting some meat and you were packing it in salt, or you were pulling some meat out that had been packed in salt and you were making it for your family. So he takes something that is an everyday, ordinary thing, and they understand what salt is for. Salt is a preservative. It keeps things from rotting, from stinking. And he says, your life is salt. Your life is to preserve a rotting culture. In a place where God is secondary at best. A lot of times God is far, far, far down the line. Your life and the way that you live and the way you talk about and live out a godly life, you are salt. And then he takes this abstract, I'm not sure what Jesus is driving at. He takes this very practical thing of salt, and then Jesus delivers a strong blow in the next part of verse 13. He says, "But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men." So Jesus says, if you in your relationship with God and all of your religious activities and the way that you show up at church and you give your tithe and you serve, and if all of those things are not salt in a rotting culture, your relationship with God isn't worth much. Man, Jesus is not afraid to throw a body blow here and there, is he? He is not afraid to call us out on the ways that we sometimes take God for granted and just say, well, I'm a follower of Jesus. I go to church, I give my tithe, I serve, I do all of the church religious things. For them, Jesus often ends up talking about their hand-washing rituals, their sacrifice rituals, all of those kind of things that were so important that marked them as religious Jews. And Jesus says, if those things do not drive you to be salt in a culture that is wasting away, it's not worth much. He continues to talk. Well, before we go to the next sentence there, I think it's interesting looking at the blessings that Jesus offers in the previous verses. Why is it that when we see compassion, it's not considered weak? When we see love expressed, it's not taken as, well, they're a lesser person for the love that they give. When mercy is shown, it is something that is good. It's something that we gather around. When peace is sought after, it's a good thing. I mean, these are all the things that Jesus ends up talking about in more in those first few verses in Matthew chapter 5. Blessed are you who are mourning, who are sorrowful, who are at the bottom of the barrel, who have nothing. And when we see someone gather around those that are in need of comfort and compassion, of love, we don't look at that and say, shame on that person. That's just a waste of time. We don't do that, do we? Unless we are very calloused and hard of heart. When we see those things, we say, that is what life is supposed to look like. And you don't even have to be a follower of Jesus. You don't have to know about God, about anything about God, to know that those are good qualities. So this thing that Jesus starts with in his first public message, in the place where he's able to gather and build some steam and a following of people that will come close to him, that's where he starts. Mercy, compassion, love. We look at those things and we say, those are the building blocks of what life is supposed to be about. Those are some important pieces. These are things that are good, that Jesus invites us to have those things marked out in our lives. Look at verse 14 then. You are the light of the world. You are the light of the world. I think this is kind of an interesting phrase, especially when you consider the world that people in the first century knew about at that moment. You are the light of the world. For them, the world was very small. Most people in the first century, and especially in that part of the world, did not travel more than 15 or so miles in any direction from their home. What they knew about the world was very small. It was very limited. Now, we may not travel to all kind of places around the world, but we have the ability to look at and see and take in things from all cultures throughout the world. It's one of the things that as the world has gotten a little bit flatter for us, we are able to see and experience things that are not native to our own Gratiot County, middle of Michigan. But for them, the world was very small, and Jesus says, you are the light of the world. I would imagine this would have struck a chord saying, my world isn't that big. My light cannot be possibly that large because I live with my parents and even one of my grandparents is still alive. They would all live together dominantly. And their circle of influence would be a family and maybe a handful of people that they worked with or did exchanges and bartering and trading with. So the world would have been very small. And the thing that Jesus is doing about this picture that he's painting is he is saying, your world is not just limited to the sphere of influence that you know about. Your world is much, much larger and expands farther beyond even the things that you know about right now. Think about this. Jesus starts planting the seeds with this, his first big message, his big sermon. He starts planting the seeds of love and compassion and leaning into one another. And it is because those seeds took root in the hearts of some of the people in the first century that were gathered on that mountain. It is because of those people that we are here today. Just think about that. How significant it is that those people allowed the things that Jesus said to actually take root in their heart and their life and change the way that they lived and the way they interacted with people. That love was this central building block on the rest of their lives. We stand here and we gather today in part, due in part to those people allowing God's word to penetrate their hearts, to change the way they lived. Their influence was much greater than just the people that they knew. The same thing is true for you and I. We tend maybe to look around us and say, well, who cares about this a little church in a little town in the middle of Michigan in a farming community? I mean, who knows about St. Louis outside of Gratiot County? The truth is, not a lot of people, right? You say St. Louis and they ask you about Missouri. But your influence, my influence, is greater than the people that you go to church with, the people that are in your family. It reaches beyond the immediate generation that you are a part of. It was true of those people there. And this is why Jesus' words are so important. You are the light of the world because your world expands far beyond even what you know today. Look at more of verse 14. He says, you are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. One of the things that happens in translation from one language to another as the Bible is written in a handful of languages, and then we bring all of those languages into the English as we read it in our Bibles today. One of the words that kind of gets lost a little bit in translation is this, and your Bible might say this, that a city built on a hill, that's a fair understanding of what Jesus is saying, but the original word would be placed on a hill. That is a city placed intentionally with purpose on a hill cannot be hidden. And here's why this is significant. In the Middle East, white limestone is abundant. It is one of the primary building blocks that they use, especially in building towns and buildings within a city. At night, with the white limestone, as people have lit candles and torches and all kinds of things, if you were traveling and could see the city from a distance, the city almost would glow a little bit. The rest of the hillside would be dark, maybe a fire here with shepherds and over there. But you would see this little glow of a city, and you would know, we're close, we're on our way. We're headed in the right direction. The same kind of thing would happen during the daytime. If you were traveling from a distance and you were still a ways off from a city, the sun would hit the white limestone and create almost this beacon of light. The hillside would have this similar light cast over it, but there would be this one bright spot, almost like a spotlight coming from the city, and you would know we're close, we're on our way. He says, a city that is placed on a hill with great intention and purpose cannot be hidden. And one of the things I think that Jesus is asking us to pay attention to is, I think we at times assume that our lives are ordinary and by chance, and there's nothing intentional about it. And Jesus is saying, your life and the where you are, you have been placed intentionally with great purpose, strategically placed individual. And I think immediately our defenses go up and we'll say, you don't really know my circumstance. You don't know, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm supposed to have a different job. I'll be changing jobs soon. I am not strategically placed to where I am at all. Or I have lived in the same house all of my adult life, maybe even the house that you grew up in. I am not strategically placed. This is just where I landed. I've lived here my whole life. There's nothing strategic or intentional or purposeful about where I live. And Jesus would say, not true. It's not true at all. For students, you guys going back to school, I am barely able to handle that we are starting school again. I am not strategically placed. My son and I have been talking about his locker, and he says, I don't know my locker combination at all. I mean, he's a little bit amped up because he's going over to the junior and senior high school. You got to change classes now, and everything's kind of all a twitter. I'm not strategically placed. I am going to just barely survive getting through from day to day. And God would say, it's not true. You are where you are for a purpose. God has put you there. He has allowed the circumstances of your life to lead to this very day, to this very moment, that God has great purpose and intention for where you are right now. I don't know if I've ever told this story about my own family history. When I was a senior in high school, there was, I think it was a second uncle or something like that. He was not a direct uncle of mine, part of our family, and there was always this mystery surrounding my great-grandpa Charlie. My great-grandpa Charlie had disappeared at some point, I think he was in his 30s or 40s. He was just gone. And this uncle of mine had decided, you know what, enough time has passed, I'm going to find out what happened to great grandpa Charlie. And so he starts doing some research. This started happening when I was, I think, a senior in high school. And what he began to find out was kind of interesting. My great grandpa Charlie had just up and disappeared. He said that he painted signs, like billboard signs, and he's always on the road. And what began to be found out is, and maybe this is the reason I haven't told this story, because hang on to your seats, my great-grandfather was a hitman for the mob. There it is. He has a colorful, to say the least, history about the things that he did and the people that he engaged with. He disappeared right around the time of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. That's why he just kind of up and disappeared. He was later arrested in New York and spent the last of his days in a prison in New Jersey. Back home, my parents are both from Fort Wayne, Indiana. And my dad's family, well, it would be his father and then his grandmother were kind of left. And my grandmother ultimately declared Charlie dead because he just disappeared. He never came back. So she had him declared dead, and there was another man that kind of fell in love with my great-grandmother, and he married her and adopted all of the kids, including my grandfather, Bud. Loved them, took care of them as if they were his own. Planted the seeds of what became my grandparents' home, where my dad grew up. Out of my dad's family, there is a tremendous story of my grandparents finding Christ at a Billy Graham crusade and just kind of turning their whole life upside down and committing themselves to follow God from that very moment. I mean, it's just a radical transformation. It would have been really easy for my grandparents just to adopt the legacy that had been handed down, though they didn't know all of the details. It would have been really easy just to adopt this orphan mentality that said, well, you're not really my dad, and my dad is really gone, and just adopt this angst-filled life. And instead, they allowed God to rescue them and planted the seeds for what became my family. Now, out of my dad's family, he was one of five. Either came pastors or young women who married pastors or those who are deeply involved in their local churches that became the roots of my larger extended family. And all of my cousins and the men and women that they married are deeply connected to churches all over the country. Now, I don't say that to you to, hey, look at me and how great my family is, because I know that some of you have very difficult stories that are part of your family. However, God can rescue where you sit today. He can bring you into a future that goes far beyond the things that you know right now. See, because we do not have to be bound by the things that once were. God is saying, I have a future for you that is far greater and reaches far, much farther than you can even imagine. There simply has to be this willingness to say, I am tired of doing this on my own. I'm done trying to survive and make it work by myself. You have been strategically placed for a time like this. Look at the rest of verse 15, or verse 15 in general. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on a stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. There is this purposeful thing. You know, you would never light something in your home and then hide it somewhere where nobody can experience it. He is saying, not only are you light, but you have the opportunity to change everything around you. Everything around you. Then look at verse 16. In the same way, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and say, dang, he's a good Christian. Is that what it says? No. That's not what it says. Jesus says that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. So what he's saying is, remove your ego and your desire for recognition and fame or whatever else gets in the way of your relationship with God. Remove all of that and allow your good deeds to be done so that people recognize that you are a disciple of God. That's what he is inviting us into. Not that we might say, look at all that I am doing. Look at all that I am accomplishing. It's kind of interesting. In our celebrity and fame culture, we pay attention to athletes and movie stars and people who are on TV, all of those kind of things. And there are some high-profile movie stars and athletes that are just doing tremendous work. Very altruistic, giving a lot of their money away, putting wells in places in Africa, making sure that kids have education and food and shoes and all of those things. But the one thing that is consistently talked about, and those that are doing that do not have Christ as a rooting part of their life, is just that how good they are on their own. Christ is saying, do not get sucked into that. Make sure that you and I are doing things so that other people not just see us and how great and beautiful and wonderful we are, but they see us and say, there is something else driving that. Who does that? Who loves like that? Who gives like that? Every time I turn around, they're giving more of themselves away. Who does that? And you and I have the opportunity to say, you know what, it's not me. I couldn't keep up this pace, but God continues to give me strength, ideas, creativity, resources to do the things that you're seeing. That's what Jesus is asking and inviting in this statement. Let your good deeds be seen so that people don't just talk about how great you are, but because of the things that God has done. We all show up in people's lives in one way or another. Sometimes their influence is very good. Sometimes it is very bad. Sometimes it's just kind of there. I was thinking about this over this past week. I was catching up on some reading There's one of my favorite online authors. His name is Jonathan Merritt. And if you're on Facebook, you might have seen me. I posted this article. It was about Christian bullies. And it was really centered on our online relationships. People have this sense of freedom that they can say almost anything they want to online. Anybody ever experienced that? And you can do it somewhat anonymously, or you can be real bold and put your name out there and call people all kinds of things. And what he was saying in this article, I thought it was just very telling. He said, we begin to lose contact with the fact that these are actual people that we may respond to. And what he was saying is, we have no trouble finding someone who disagrees with us and really blasting them, just completely destroying any argument that they might have and calling them unbelievable, ungodly, unchristian names. These come from people who are professed Christians. And the more I read of this article and some of the things that he cited, I was so disappointed. I was just crushed. Because here's one of the primary reasons that was so disappointing. He was right. That sometimes when we show up, our desire is to just crush anything in our path and just tear people down and ruin reputations and smash people and really simply say, I am right no matter what. You can have your own opinion, but you're wrong. That is kind of how some people choose to respond to difficult situations. And I'm not suggesting that in the midst of difficult conversations that we as Christians be quiet and sit on our hands. Not at all. But if love is the foundational piece of what it means to be a disciple of Christ, that needs to be the place that we begin those difficult conversations. If you were here last week, you heard me say one of my biggest frustrations is that we who are Christians expect those who are not Christians to act like Christians. It is completely out of bounds on our part. And I am guilty of it. I have done it. So there has to be this place of corrective behavior on our parts, because some of us show up in other people's lives and that is the kind of legacy we live, and we burn all kinds of bridges, and it gives people ammunition to say, I knew you Christians were like this. And yes, it's a blanket statement, but it feels true when you have been attacked and crushed by someone who claims to follow Jesus and yet does not seem to love like Jesus at all. I think it was Gandhi that said, I like your Jesus, I just don't like your Christians. So some people show up in this difficult, problematic, argumentative way. And then that other people show up, like a couple that I mentioned earlier, Dan and Deb Schaefer. These two people have experienced an unbelievable amount of physical difficulty. Deb has some sort of physical issues. There's something going on in her body that is causing her throat to continue to close to a point where she could not breathe. So now Deb has a trach hole where they cut open her throat. And she can only talk now by kind of covering up and causing the vibration to happen and all of those. And you guys are, some of you are very familiar with that. And she sits next to her husband, Dan. And when I met Dan, Dan is probably a good 2 or 3 inches taller than me. He's a big, strong farm guy. Probably outweighed me by 30 or 40 pounds. Just a big man. Now Dan sits in his chair and he is a shrunken, shriveled remainder of the man that he used to be 6-8 months ago. I mean, the cancer has attacked and destroyed his body on the inside. He has been on and off again in so much pain that you can't really even hold his hand to pray with him. The cancer is just destroying him. He had to go a week ago Monday, to the hospital in Midland because his lungs were filling up with fluid so much so that he could not catch his breath. He had to go and they had to drain an unbelievable amount of fluid out of his lungs. And he said, I don't know, I may have to go and do that yet again. And part of the reason I tell you this story is not so that you'll feel bad for them, because that is the last thing that they want. God has continued to work in their hearts and minds that they continue to sit and they hold each other's hands. And Deb simply says, God is doing something through this, through all of the struggles that they have, all of the physical limitations and inability to really even live decent lives. They say, God is doing something through this. Every time I visit with him, I say, all right, Dan, is there anything I can pray for you about? He says, don't pray for me. Pray for my boys. He's got three sons. He says, they don't know God right now. They're willing to engage in conversations about God only to a certain point, and then just kind of, I'm done. And it's painful because they're losing their father. They just lost their mother about 8 months ago to cancer. Dan says, God is using my sickness, and he says, probably my death, to get to my boys. And he is perfectly at ease with that. He said, don't pray for me. You don't need to pray for me. I'm fine. And, I mean, if you know anything about cancer, he's not fine. He has to go and start chemotherapy later this week, and it is going to rack his body again. But his concern is not for himself. See, Dan is showing up in the lives of everyone around him. When he goes down to the VA hospital in Ann Arbor, his light is showing as bright as it could be. He is one of the saltiest, and I mean this in a good way, in a biblical sense, one of the saltiest people that walk in through those doors. Because he is not allowing the conditions and the circumstances of right now to determine how well he follows Christ. See, there are two things. There's one thing each that salt and light do. Salt always preserves, and light always shows the way. That is what Dan and Deb are doing. So when I request prayer for them, pray that God will use what's going on. You can pray for Dan's healing. I'm sure Dan would take healing. But the thing that he is most concerned about is his boys. Because Dan has become salt and light in that very difficult circumstance. Salt always preserves. Light always shows the way. And here's the truth about you and me. You think back to your conversion experience. If you sit here this morning as one who is saved through Christ, think back to the people who were involved in your life. How did you get to the place that you are now? You didn't show up on your own. Someone was salt and light in your life. Think about who that person was. And maybe it was the kind of thing that they weren't even trying to. They were just kind of like you, just trying to get through the day, and yet they act some way different. And they became, and then you find out later, oh, you're a Christian? I didn't even know that about you. And they became someone who began to change your life simply by the way that they acted and they lived. This is what Jesus is inviting us to do, to be salt and light. So maybe the question that we have to ask ourselves is, how salty are you this morning? Are you the kind of person that everywhere you go, because see, some of you are really good at this, reflecting on that last piece that Jesus says, that people will see the good things that you do and point to your Father in heaven. Some of you are really good at this. Because as life throws you all kinds of things, you just continue to say, it is because I'm a child of God that I am here. It is because of what God is doing that I am making it through this. So some of you are really good at this. You are salty and you are bright light. And then there are some of us who are just content with the idea that, well, I'm saved and I'm going to heaven. You have settled into being a Christian. And I say settled because of what Jesus says here. If you are not salt and light, you have settled. Same thing is true of me. I mean, I can work all week preparing and getting ready for Sunday and reading the Bible and making sure that things are ready to go and still miss Jesus in the midst of this and not be salt and light. So I'm going to pray and we're going to do what we would normally do. We're going to sing some. We're going to allow God some space to speak to us. And I just know that as we are standing here, as we get ready to sing and engage in worship, that God is calling some of you out of very specific things to become more salt and greater light in the places that you live. Heavenly Father, as we close this morning, you have spoken to some of us very strongly, strongly about the lives that we have lived, the kind of influence that we are and the way we have shown up in the lives of other people. And for some of us, we need to allow there to be greater salt and light in our lives. That maybe for some of us, we've settled.
And we've become merely Christians. So God, if that is where we are, if we recognize that is a part of our life this morning, help us find our way back to you. Father, maybe we have realized that we've been overly aggressive in some of our relationships, that we've become a little bit of a Christian bully in the way in which we talk and engage with other people. Father, if that is the case, this is a wonderful opportunity for us to repent of those things, to find forgiveness, to ask for your strength for these things to change in our hearts. Whatever the case is, Father, whether it is those things or some others that have come to the surface this morning, we just ask very simply that we would experience communion with you this morning. You would call us by name, that we could come to the table and be with you. Father God, we thank you for the privilege of calling you Father. In Jesus' name.